The fall of Saigon was the last act in a very long war. It began in the 1940s when the Japanese invaded Vietnam. When they were defeated and driven out at the end of World War II, the French colonial government returned to rule the country. But Vietnamese nationalists began a guerrilla war against the French and spectacularly defeated them at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Vietnam was then divided into two countries. North Vietnam, with its capital Hanoi, was ruled by communists, and South Vietnam, with its capital Saigon, was capitalist. The communists ruling the north were also nationalists, and they continued a campaign to try to unify the country by force. The United States came to the aid of the capitalist South. And in the late 60s and early 70s, hundreds of thousands of American troops fought alongside the South Vietnamese. This bloody and costly American involvement in Vietnam ended in 1973. But the war between the North and the South went on. Early in 1975, the war was going badly for the South, but people had not given up hope. Phan Lem Hong, then living in Saigon, had good personal reasons for being optimistic.
I was just married, and in spite of all the bad news from the battlefields, we still could not believe that Saigon could fall.
But the news from the battlefield didn't improve. The Northern Army was getting nearer and nearer Saigon. For Saigon resident Tran Viet Hung, it was a BBC broadcast which first made him realize how bad things were.
About 10 days before Saigon's fall, it said that the speed of the retreat of the South Vietnamese army was even faster than the speed of the advance of the North Vietnamese army. And I thought, that's something very strange and terrible. It can't be true.
Decisions by South Vietnamese generals to abandon the country's second biggest city, Da Nang, and the strategically important Central Highlands had badly undermined the army's morale. Nick Nugent was working for the BBC's Vietnamese service at the time.
Those orders coming from Saigon sent messages of panic. People fled. They could see very clearly that the people at the top, the government, were panicking, and so they panicked.
By the end of April, Saigon itself was beginning to look seriously threatened. Part of Nick Nugent's work, as the communist armies closed in, was to record the news dispatches sent back to the BBC in London from the two BBC correspondents still in the city.
I well remember Brian Barron came back from the bridge on the outskirts of Saigon to report this tremendous battle that had been going on for that bridge. It was the final battle of the war. We didn't know then, but it was the final battle of the war, and within a day or so, Saigon itself fell.
The drama unfolded through the last few days of April 1975. Brian Barron's memories of that time are as vivid as if it happened yesterday.
That particular battle was for the Binh Hoa Bridge, which was this enormous American-built bridge across the Saigon River on the edge of town. It took place about 5 days before Saigon fell. Suddenly, a very small group of communist commandos seized positions at the far end of the bridge, and the southern reaction was very fragmented. They weren't very sure what to do. Meanwhile, lots of other southerners, southern civilians, were looting warehouses of food and supplies almost within sight of this bridge. So you had a feeling of a giant headless chicken. Here it was about to be dismembered, about to be killed off, and yet all around it, there were people desperately trying to profit from it in its final death agonies.
Lee Man-hung had a vitally important government job, which kept him in the city to the very end. Like thousands of other Vietnamese who had worked closely with the Americans, he had been promised safe passage out of the country if the South was defeated. But just 2 days before the city's fall, these plans began to collapse.
Giai đoạn đầu tiên đến vào cuối ngày 28 tháng 4.
The first moment came at the end of the 28th of April, when the airport was shelled by communist guns and no plane could land or take off. This was the first time that I realized that I might not get away before the fall of Saigon. On the 29th, the American helicopters started evacuating people. We were given the name of a place to gather if the airport was under attack and out of use. We were told that if we went to this place, we would be picked up by American helicopters. But when we got there, it was full of people, and we couldn't get to the top of the building where the helicopters were supposed to land, so we decided we may as well go home.
The helicopters were ferrying queues of people who were lined up on rooftops of various buildings, mostly within sight of the American embassy. And when the last helicopter came and went, and silence returned to central Saigon, apart from the distant rumble of artillery and rockets, when that silence descended, there were still hundreds, if not thousands, of people standing on those roofs. It was a very melancholy sight.
Phan Lim Hung and her husband gave up the struggle to escape from the city. She was worried about what would happen to her father, who had been a former prime minister of South Vietnam. But how did she feel herself as the reality of the South's defeat sank in?
Was it because I was pregnant at the time, or was it because the loss was so great? It didn't seem to register very much. I remember that when I came back to my father's house, I was in a complete daze. You pick up something and put it down and pick up another thing. And the whole thing seemed so unreal. It was like in a bad dream.
On the 30th of April, 1975, bad dreams were coming true all over Saigon. Brian Barron drove with another journalist to the bridge that had been the scene of the battle he'd reported 5 days earlier. There, they ran into a group of South Vietnamese soldiers, led by a panic-stricken colonel.
He had had a mental breakdown, and he literally was frothing at the mouth, and they were armed to the teeth. And he said, look, you're communist spies. So he forced us out of the car at gunpoint, and I thought he was going to shoot us all in the back. And he forced us to park this very large car right across the highway at the Saigon end of the Binh Hoa Bridge. And then we crept away one by one. And when I went back to the bridge about 3 hours later, after the city had fallen, our car had been run over by the lead column of North Vietnamese tanks, and it was just a splintered mass of wreckage at the side of the road.
All over Saigon, desperate South Vietnamese soldiers were taking off their uniforms. But Lê Man Hung remembers how surprised he was by his first sight of the feared and victorious North Vietnamese army as it entered the city.
Cảm nghĩ đầu tiên của tôi không phải là mấy chiếc xe tăng.
My first impression was not of the tanks, but the infantry following the tanks. They looked so young. They looked about 15 or 16. And they looked sad.
Or were they just confused? Many North Vietnamese soldiers had spent years fighting in the jungle and had never seen a large city. There were reports of several tanks getting lost in this new urban jungle. Phan Lim Hong says the moment of defeat first dawned for her when she saw the North Vietnamese flag flying from the presidential palace. She and her husband had belonged to the South Vietnamese elite, so for them, this really was a moment that turned their life upside down.
We were thrown out of our house. We lost our jobs. We become a second-class citizen. You know, overnight, we've lost everything we have.
Phan Lim Hong's husband, Le Man Hung, was sent to a so-called re-education camp in the countryside, far from Saigon. He had to stay in this prison in all but name for 6 years.
I became a manual laborer, doing the dirtiest jobs. Every morning, I had to go around collecting night soil from the toilets and bringing it to a central pit to mix it with water. This was a kind of dirty manual labor which contrasted strongly with my previous life.
In the wider political world, as the BBC's Nick Nugent points out, the fall of Saigon was a moment of deep humiliation for the United States.
A real kick in the face, if you like, because the Americans were and are a superpower, the strongest power on earth, and here they'd been defeated by what was regarded as a ragtag army, I mean an ill-equipped third world army. So it was an enormous humiliation, which perhaps is why the fall of Saigon stands out as a sort of turning point in 20th century history. And secondly, it was seen as a major victory for communism, and this at the middle of what Europe has called the Cold War between communism and non-communism seemed to be a triumph, a victory for communist forces. Communism was advancing.
Well, that's how it looked then. But today, communism is in retreat, and America is still a superpower. The communists, as Brian Barron says, lost the peace.
In those intervening years, since I witnessed those tanks sweeping through the gates of the palace and seizing Saigon, they failed to have the imagination to be sufficiently tolerant and flexible to maximise the enormous prize they'd seized through military force. And that's why Vietnam today still languishes as a poor country.
So how did the fall of Saigon change our world? Above all, perhaps, it finally closed the door on colonialism, on the notion that powerful countries could rule or manipulate weaker countries against their will. Much more surprisingly, it was also a turning point in the history of communism, but not one which communists would wish to celebrate today.
Yes, it is a lot different now looking back. We suddenly realize that in a way, it was the beginning of the end of communism as we knew it.